Our series, Are You Covered?, is produced in partnership with Kaiser Health News, a nonprofit news service. It's an editorially independent program of the Kaiser Family Foundation, which is not affiliated with Kaiser Permanente. Also working with us as part of this series is NPR's Julie Rovner, and she's with us in the studio. Julie, under these so-called Cadillac plans, what would happen to the Lovells and the Stabbies under the bills being considered in Congress right now?
Well, their health insurance plans would probably only be directly affected by one of the bills under consideration. That's the bill that's before the Senate Finance Committee, and it actually starts work today on that bill. The bill would impose an excise tax on health plans that are sponsored by an insurer that exceed a certain value. And this wouldn't start until the year 2013. And by then, the tax would start on plans that cost more than $8,000 for an individual and more than $21,000 for family coverage. So there would be a tax on the amount over those thresholds for those types of plans. So it would be only the most expensive plans starting in the year 2013.
But who pays the tax? The insured or those providing the insurance? Who?
Well, the way it's written, the tax is technically levied on the health insurance plan. But the reality that everybody knows is what's going to happen is that that tax will be passed through first to the employer, and the employer then would either pass it through to the workers via higher premiums for them or lower wages, or what everybody assumes will happen is the employer will simply stop offering such generous coverage.
So in other words, it's kind of a backdoor way to tax employer health insurance, the kind of thing we've been hearing about, we heard about in the presidential campaign.
It absolutely is. Now, again, these are only on what we call these so-called Cadillac plans, the most expensive with the most generous benefits. The idea is that taxpayers shouldn't be subsidizing plans at the very high end. But there is a recognition, as we've seen with these families, that many workers have given up wages to get these generous benefits, and many states simply have higher costs for health insurance. So plans that are not all that generous might get caught inadvertently by this tax. The bill, as it stands now, gives 17 states in which health care was deemed, quote, least affordable, special dispensations. They would have higher thresholds, at least at first, before the tax kicked in.
Do you think this is going to happen?
It's still extremely controversial. I imagine there will be a lot of heated debate as the Finance Committee goes forward. But a lot of economists say that the very existence of these very generous plans encourages people to overuse health care. This is one important way to start holding down health care costs. Although, as we've seen, for many people, these plans are literally lifesavers.
NPR's Julie Rovner, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Later today, on All Things Considered, Julie has the next report in our series, Are You Covered? It's the story of a woman with breast cancer who had private insurance when she first underwent treatment. Years later, when the disease came back, she was treated under Medicare. We'll hear about both experiences.
Ever since the economy began nosediving, we've been hearing a lot about the Great Depression. Coincidentally, the distinguished literary scholar Morris Dickstein has been at work for years on a book about the culture of the Depression era. It's just come out, and it's called Dancing in the Dark. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says Dickstein's timing, and much else in this new book, is near perfect.
Morris Dickstein's new cultural history of the Great Depression, called Dancing in the Dark, is one of those everything-but-the-kitchen-sink kind of books. Except in this case, the kitchen sink does make an oblique appearance, given that Dickstein discusses Art Deco industrial design, as well as the dance extravaganzas of Busby Berkeley, the novels of Zora Neale Hurston, Henry Roth, and, of course, John Steinbeck, gangster movies and screwball comedies, the music of Bing Crosby, and the photography of Dorothea Lange and Margaret Burke White. The knee-jerk way to review a colossus like this is to chip away at it, to whittle it down to one's own intellectual size by regretfully pointing to what Dickstein left out. What about comic strips, or radio shows, or doggerel poetry? See, I'm not above such tricks. But Dickstein puts a stop to this kind of gamesmanship at the outset when he tells readers that he made no effort to cover everything. Instead, he says, this was a series of personal choices focusing on work that genuinely engaged me. You earn the right to take that kind of approach if you're Morris Dickstein, who's not only one of America's most perceptive literary critics, but also one of our best critical writers. What other literary scholar of such eminence would use the adjective nutty as he does at least twice here? His zesty voice, as well as his lightly worn erudition, make Dickstein's Dancing in the Dark a thrill to read. As a work of cultural history, it's the equivalent of a Fred and Ginger dance number. It makes all the sweaty scholarly steps and difficult leaps of interpretation look easy. Dickstein's aim here is nothing less than to fathom the inner history of the Great Depression through the art that gives us singular keys to its dream life, its unguarded feelings about the world. Throughout his book, Dickstein keeps executing a critical two-step. First, he wants to illuminate the art in Depression-era works that have been valued mostly as political reportage. Novels, for instance, like Mike Gold's 1930 Jews Without Money. About that book and the widespread awareness of urban poverty that it helped usher in, Dickstein tartly says, "The poor may always be with us, but we seem to notice them at 30-year intervals, like spoilers at a party for people of good conscience. The Depression was one of those moments of visibility." The second step here is to reveal the social consciousness lurking in movies, music, and dance of the period that have been dismissed as escapism. Of course, this aspect of Dickstein's book is more fun. Who wouldn't prefer spending time in the company of Cary Grant rather than the Joads? I suspect even Dickstein feels this way because his insights are particularly dazzling in the swankier sections of the book. Here's one of them. In a chapter where he discusses music and the road movies of the 30s, gems like It Happened One Night, Dickstein makes this distinction between the serious reportage of the period, which was all about being down and out and stuck, and popular entertainment. He says, "The fantasy culture of the 30s is all about movement. The look of the great 30s musicals is everything that Dorothea Lange's photographs, Migrant Mother or Woman of the High Plains, both so angular and static, are not. It's all circle and swirl, all movement and flow. Think of it," Dickstein urges, "the rose petal effect in Berkeley's big dance numbers, the sweepingly elegant curvature of the Art Deco sets, the brilliance of Astaire and Rogers. Add to that, as Dickstein does, the brisk repartee of screwball comedy, the scampering lyrics of Porter and Gershwin, and you see that he's really onto something. It's the American dream of mobility, encoded in even, say, a fantasy about picking yourself up after a dust storm, finding your courage, and following that yellow brick road." Dickstein's title, Dancing in the Dark, refers to another one of those works of popular entertainment, a 1931 ballad sung by Bing Crosby about a man and a woman clinging to each other as they're surrounded by uncertainty, darkness. Dickstein reads this image as emblematic of the impulse toward community the Depression would reawaken in Americans. If I can belabor the dance metaphor one more time, though, I'd say that a penetrating work of cultural history like this one also gives the reader who holds it fast a sense of dwelling in a circle of illumination amidst all the shadows.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Dancing in the Dark by Morris Dickstein. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tuohy-Westman, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menjivar, John Myers, and John Sheehan. I'm Terry Gross.
Dancing in the dark, till the tune ends, we're dancing in the dark. And it soon ends, we're waltzing in the wonder of why we're here. Time hurries by, we're here.
Some other news now, beginning today. You can no longer buy flavored cigarettes, the kind designed to taste like fruit, spices, or candy. The federal ban is among the first provisions to take effect since Congress passed the Tobacco Control Act this year. NPR's Adam Hochberg has more.
The flavored cigarettes carried names like Sweet Dreams and Mocha Taboo, and some of the packages looked a lot like the wrappers you see on expensive candy bars. Infused with cherries or coconut or coffee or cloves, they're a niche product in the $70 billion tobacco industry. But Matt Myers of the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids says they appeal to new smokers who find the taste of regular cigarettes too harsh.
They're a mechanism to introduce a new generation of young people to tobacco products. You never see a long-term smoker smoking a chocolate, mocha mint, vanilla, or strawberry cigarette.
Activists have lobbied for years to get the products off the market. In 2006, R.J. Reynolds agreed to stop making several of its flavored blends, such as Camel Warm Winter Toffee. But several small manufacturers continued to sell flavored cigarettes, and they'll feel the effect of today's ban. John Gagon is with Cretec International, a California importer of clove cigarettes. He says the company's complying with the law, but he argues the ban is misdirected.
The total flavored cigarette business is a little bit less than 0.2% of all the cigarettes sold. So somehow we've become the poster child for FDA enforcement, and I think it's not a big deal.
Gagon says Cretec will continue to make small cigars with flavoring, a practice that may skirt the ban, but that industry critics want the Food and Drug Administration to examine. The new law also specifically exempts menthol, a flavoring used in about a quarter of all cigarettes sold, including 70% of those smoked by African Americans. Mike Siegel at the Boston University School of Public Health says that's a major loophole.
It doesn't make a lot of sense to me to say, look, we're going to ban cigarette flavorings because they're so important, but we're going to exempt the one that's actually used the most. You know, you need to be consistent. If it's so important that we ban cigarette flavorings, then ban them.
This year's legislation does require the FDA to study the issue of menthol in cigarettes, but Matt Myers from the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids concedes that regulating such a popular ingredient is a complicated task, far more so than banning exotic flavors like pineapple or grape. Adam Hochberg, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. Today's United Nations meeting on climate change could be seen as a pep rally. The UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon wants to pump up enthusiasm for a climate treaty. It's supposed to be finished in December in Copenhagen, but it's in deep trouble. In a moment, we'll hear NPR's Juan Williams on the domestic politics of climate change. We start with NPR's Richard Harris.
Climate change is a hard problem. An effective treaty would eventually require the global economy to change directions entirely, with a shift away from fossil fuels and toward cleaner sources of energy. There's at least serious talk about starting that transition. The United States is a key player, and the House of Representatives passed a bill that is intended to move in that direction. But the issue is stalled in the Senate. Jason Grumet at the Bipartisan Policy Center says there are three main reasons for that.
The global recession, the extent to which the healthcare debate has now really crowded out all other political activity, and the deep mistrust that people in our Congress and across our country now have about market-based approaches to problem solving.
The idea of creating vast new markets to buy and sell carbon emissions suddenly sounds like not such a great idea, since exotic markets in bundled mortgages nearly led to economic collapse a year ago. Grumet says given time, there are ways to solve these problems.
The real challenge, though, is getting beyond the kind of vitriol that is now marking our larger political discussion, because if that remains, you know, I think we're going to find ourselves not making progress on any of the important issues facing the country.
And time is running short. Congress needs to agree on a domestic climate policy before the Obama administration can negotiate a credible international deal. And it's looking like there simply won't be time to come up with a climate bill before December, when the next climate treaty is supposed to be negotiated in Copenhagen.
But U.S. isn't the only problem.
Kelly Sims Gallagher at Tufts University says China is also an impediment. The Chinese government is demanding that the industrialized world make drastic cuts in its emissions before China agrees to reduce its own. Gallagher says this is not helpful.
But we have to understand China's stance as a negotiating position right now.
Countries often talk tough as a deadline approaches. She says, time's up. The United States and China, which are by far the two biggest contributors to global warming, need to sit down together and start getting serious.
if they don't start doing that this week, it's hard to imagine being able to have enough time to get through all of the contentious issues and come out of Copenhagen with an agreement.
If you ask David Victor at the University of California, San Diego, about the prospects of a deal by December...
Well, they're looking pretty bad.
The lack of U.S. domestic legislation is a big blow. So's the global economy. Rich countries don't have much money to offer the developing world, and money is what developing countries expect from these talks to help them cope with the consequences of climate change. So Victor is among a rising chorus of voices saying it's time to start thinking seriously about Plan B.
I think what needs to happen between now and Copenhagen is the diplomats need to sift through this huge list of issues on which they can't agree and find the small list of items where they can agree and where, if they fail to agree, there's going to be a big harmful impact on climate diplomacy.
For example, put in writing promises countries have already made so they don't back away from them. And don't expect to negotiate global emissions reduction targets.
And then develop a very distinct game plan for the 2 or 3 years following the Copenhagen process.
He says the worst-case scenario would be if nations lower their expectations for Copenhagen so much that nothing happens, yet everyone declares victory and goes home. Richard Harris, NPR News.
And in order to encourage kids to follow the basic rules of avoiding swine flu, such as wash your hands, well, that's a job for kids' songwriters. Bill Harley wrote this tune for students at a school in Providence, Rhode Island.
When you're sitting in class, there's a tickle in your nose. Then you let out a sneeze, yeah, it finally explodes. You look down at your hand, it's all covered with that goo. Don't wipe it anywhere. You know what to do, you gotta wash your hands. Lavate las manos, your hands.
Bill Harley is a Grammy Award-winning songwriter. He's also a storyteller. And you can download his song by going to npr.org.
Up there on the shelf. If you want to stay healthy, there's a little trick. Do it every day and you don't get sick. You got to wash your hands. Lavate de las manos, your hands.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.